You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to a very funny comedian, a lovely man, and a new friend. As you won't necessarily be aware, I had to cut 10 or 15 minutes from the beginning of this podcast because it's just us talking about comic books. So, nonetheless, there's some really excellent stuff here, and a voyage of discovery as we delve into the secret history of Mr. Fumbi Omoteo. So tell me about your Soho show. You've added extra dates because you sold out your Soho run.
Yes. So we're excited to give me more dates, which was really cool because, you know, when you come back from Edinburgh and you're like, oh, thank God I survived.
Yes.
And then they tell you got a Soho run and you're like, oh, it's going to be Edinburgh all over again. But then everyone was like, no. These people have paid to come and see you.
Yes.
You're going to love the Soho Theatre experience.
Yeah, and however much stuff there is going on in London, there is not as much stuff as there is in Edinburgh. So these
exactly.
people have made a decision.
Yeah, they've made a decision to come. And Soho Theatre is an amazing establishment on its own. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a good place to put on any show. And people come in their numbers, you know, looking for shows to watch, which is cool as well. But it's a great experience. I mean, it was the best. Doing the show again and realizing that, oh my God, it was funny. you know, Edinburgh was lying to me, you know. But no, just doing it and not having it, because Edinburgh's great, but not having the, you know, that pressure of every day trying to do the show the same way and hoping you can deliver. Even though you have no control over the mood of your audience or what they've seen or where they've been the whole day.
Yeah, they might have just come from five shows.
I asked one time, I was in Edinburgh, I said, you guys all right? They're like, yeah, we're just tired. And I was like, oh, why? They're like, I've seen five shows before yours.
Yeah, literally.
And I'm like, oh, wow. I'll round up now, should I? You know? But in Soho, they've just come for you. You know, they've hung out maybe during the day. It was in the weekend. So they're like, you know, yeah, we're going to Fumbi's show. And that was great, man. It was really good. And, you know, we had two sold out nights and Christian asked straight for another, you know, some, for more available slots, and they gave me another two
this
in July.
Mr. Knowles, your agent?
Mr. Knowles, okay. My agent, Christian Knowles, yes. He asked for another two nights, and they came back straight away and said, yeah, you can have, you know, 11th and 12th of July, which is a Monday and Tuesday, but I was just really excited to try and do it again, you know, it's nice.
So tell me about, was this your first Edinburgh doing an hour?
My first Edinburgh doing an hour.
Okay, because you've been going for a mysteriously mobile amount of time.
Yeah, just short little trips, you know. The first time I did the Amuse-Muse final in Edinburgh, that was my first experience of Edinburgh.
Okay.
So I was only there for a week, you know. It was nice to see everyone else suffer and you're just kind of in and out. You know, you see all the other comics like really just going to their shows and trying to focus, and you're just like, whew, I don't have to do that. You know,
yeah,
I just
right.
do little spots here and
there. Turn up in a bathrobe halfway through the festival. Yeah, okay.
Chill out. Then the next year, I did a two-hander with Prince Abdi. And we just kind of did, I think it was East Meets West or something like that. I can't remember one corny name we found, came up with. And we went up there, and that was. And I did the lunchtime special with Christian Knowles as well, CKP showcase, which was good. It was we did that every afternoon, and that gave me the feel of Edinburgh. You know, I had to learn from watching other people because some of my friends were doing hour shows and stuff like that, and so I was just observing it through their eyes. And then this last year I went, I did the first hour. I wanted to go out there, you know, and do. To be honest with you, it was just watching people like Dane and Ola who would put on a show and done an hour and just saw how, you know, they put a show together and got the good response and the responses they deserved. I figured, you know, it's time for me to now, you know, stop being afraid and just take that jump.
Okay.
And then I went up there last year with the hour. legal immigrant. And yeah, it was.
Now, even before coming to the Edinburgh Festival, you actually have like a secret past within comedy.
Yes.
In that you've been like, you got the newcomer award for the black comedy circuit. Yeah. Or what was that? What was the
I like
how
you said secret past, Stuart, like you have to dig deep and find what Fumbi's been doing, you know?
Well, I tell you why I said that is because I know that you like, you've come from, you were on the black circuit for, I don't know, for how long?
8 years.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, 2004 I started on that
one. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, that might not be a secret past, certainly it's kind of separate from the sphere of Edinburgh shows that we're used to. So I suppose what I'm dancing around is the fact that like you won a newcomer award on the mainstream circuit and then, having been around for 8 years. Tell me about that.
Well, what it is, I guess it's when I first started in 2004, you know, my sister just called up a comedian whose name's Kojo, who was looking for acts to perform at his comedy club. And she just said, yeah, my brother can do 5 minutes. And I was like, I can.
No, were you a performer at that time?
I went to drama school. I was at the Poor School.
Okay.
At the time, I was doing drama at the Poor School, which is in Pentonville Road. And it was a lot because I was working at Harrods in the morning, going to drama school in the evening.
Yes.
I didn't understand the concept of drama school, how it's a very demanding place. You know, you really have to be in the right frame of mind every evening to, you know, to do these characters. And it was just taking
so the Poor School just takes place in the evening, so that everyone could do their day jobs.
Yeah, so everyone could do their day jobs or whatever you did during the day, but it was full on in the evenings. And you come to drama school tired, you're just not going to get the best out of it, you know?
Sure.
And so, because the thing is, I didn't think I could do stand up. I don't know if anyone thinks they can do stand up straight off. I figured, you know what, I'm funny, but I can do comedy acting. You know, I don't want to do stand up because that's a different skill entirely. You know, I was more worried about being embarrassed, not getting people, you know, people not laughing at you on stage. But then eventually I just thought, okay, let me try the stand-up. And with the black audiences, it was almost made sense because you didn't have to go too far to get them to understand you. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
In the sense where it was predominantly black audiences, right? So we've all grown up in the same experiences.
Okay.
Going to the same schools, growing up in the same neighborhoods, experiencing the same clubs. So to talk about those experiences was very simple. It was, I won't say easy, but it was reachable. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
I was Nigerian as well. So, and there was a lot of Nigerians in the audience.
Presumably still are.
Yes.
Because back then I was Nigerian.
I was Nigerian, now I'm changed. No. But being Nigerian at the time, there was this buzz between Nigerians. There's a lot of Nigerians and Caribbeans, Jamaicans. Those are dominant, you know, black race, grim nations.
Okay.
And then you had everyone else. And if you had like, I don't know, maybe 70 Nigerians in an audience of 150 people, and you just came out with some good Nigerian solid gags, you're getting serious laughs.
Okay.
Yeah. So they were on your side already. So it was so easy to just kind of blow up because it just exploded. Like everybody was into this urban comedy movement. It was like, it's really funny, Chris and Stuart, because people, it was almost like people had, were thinking, oh my God, finally some comedy I can actually enjoy.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? That was like the vibe. People were coming out in numbers and we didn't even fly for this event. It was just word of mouth. And then when Facebook came and MySpace and stuff like that, it just doubled it. So you have all these people coming to these events because they've heard there's some comedians who are really funny. People were doing one-man shows after two nights at Cork's Wine Bar.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I'm talking booking Hackney Empire and booking Cap Theatre, doing like an hour set.
Okay.
After just being on the comedy circuit for like, what, 2 months?
That's nuts!
That is crazy,
I was having this conversation with Tanya Moore recently about just how nuts it is that there is a black circuit.
Yes.
Right? I'm going to put my hat... I've never worked the black circuit. I've never done any black circuit gigs. Yeah. I feel slightly weird about calling it the black circuit.
But we used to call it the mainstream. So we used to call it the white circuit. Even though it wasn't the white circuit, we just knew it was predominantly white comics with a white audience. And so we knew... To break it to the next level, you had to go on the white circuit. But here was the interesting thing. How'd you go away from people calling your name and screaming you and checking you on Facebook?
Well, this
to
is
people
the question.
Saying, what the hell is that?
You've got to restart all over again,
you
haven't
had to
you?
Rethink.
So let's spend a little bit of time about this before we get into the reinvention.
Yeah.
I have seen some videos that are on YouTube of you doing black circuit gigs.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to talk about there in terms of the difference between your performance style, your energy on stage. There's loads of issues, loads of stuff to talk about. But let's just get into, before we get into that, before you went to the Poor School, had you as a kid had performative ambitions?
No.
None whatsoever.
Not at all.
So who are you? Tell us who you are as a kid, where you are, and what you are.
The thing is, growing up as a kid, I grew up in London. So okay. My parents are Nigerian. I grew up in London. And when you grew up in an African home, it's education. Because they didn't see any other way out of, I wouldn't say poverty, but the way we grew up, they didn't see any way out than you being educated and getting a very good job. Yeah. So be a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant. However, if you look at how society works, when you grew up in a neighborhood like Hackney or Brixton, or the only way out is through entertainment, football, or some kind of sport.
Yeah, okay.
So it actually made sense to push us into the arts, but they never did. They wanted us to get education. And when I was 10...
I'm just going to pause on that for a second. I've never heard that idea. It would make sense to push you into the arts.
Because it's pretty much this highest success rate for how these people leave these neighborhoods.
So why do you think people don't do that? Because of the lottery,
because of the idea that my parents can love Michael Jackson, my parents can love Kobe Bryant or Lionel Messi, but to see your child as that person is where it becomes... I had a lot of uncles who were like, look, you can't be a comedian. It's not a real, you know, ambition. It's a hobby. Yes. You need to go and do something that is tried and tested in their minds.
Okay.
However, you know, you when you grow up in this world and you do things and you look around, you realize, you know, even the education road is not, you know, certified. You know, it all depends on what universities you go to and, you know, the jobs you can get. It's so much more, sure, as well. So, but they don't see that, you know.
So were your parents, they were Nigerian, and when did they come to the UK before you were born?
Late 70s, okay, they came, okay, in. And so
the kind of the cultural map of what's available for your child is so different today, course, to what it was in the 70s.
Course,
but anyone coming here is going to go, you've got to be straight, legit part of the system.
Yes, yes. Okay. And that was the mindset then. Because you can imagine then, it was different times. And so, you know, you're not seeing any black people on TV. So you're telling your mom, I want to be on TV. Like, good luck with that. You know,
Did
you see anyone on TV? You know? And those are the things that, you know, you believe in. And then when I was 10, we moved to Nigeria for 6 years.
Yes.
So then I'm totally out of, you know, entertainment. In Nigeria, it was straight education. Only recently now, they have a entertainment industry and a movie industry that's really big. But back then, it was unheard of. You had to go to school. So when I came back to London, that's the mindset. You know, I'm going to get a job. I was trying to be an engineer, Stuart. Don't ask me why.
As soon as anyone says, don't ask me why, I have to ask you why. Did it just seem like that was a thing that would please your parents?
I'm ashamed to say this, okay? Because there's no... It doesn't even have an association. But I like to change the light bulbs in the house. Figured that has something to do with engineering, maybe electrical engineering.
I'm sure on some level it does. If you find that... you found it satisfying to fix a problem.
Like, Bob, I figured, you know what? I'll take it to engineering now. That was my maths, basically.
Okay.
But it made no sense. And, eventually you start to... Because when I went to college, I went to College of North East London in Tottenham. And it was not a college where education was going to be a factor. We were more interested in rap and chicken girls.
Okay.
And I was in the canteen. I used to make people laugh every single day. And it wasn't a thing where that was what I wanted to do. It just happened a lot, you know? And I started to think to myself, okay, I have a decision to make, you know, either I continue just wasting time and then, you know, end up working, you know, climbing up the Tesco ladder, or I can make something of my life and try and use my gift that I felt I had.
Okay.
And that's when I decided to go to drama school.
So what kind of funny kid were you? There's lots of different types of funny kids, you know, in the canteen.
There are. And so everybody says, were you the class clown? You're like, no, I wasn't a class clown. The class clown is almost the one that seeks attention. Can't stop being funny. You know, everything is funny. I was more of, when it came, I could handle it. Okay. You know, I never tried to be funny because I, funny enough, I don't like being center of attention. You know, I don't crave that moment. Whereas some funny people just they couldn't care less. They want to be in that moment, whether they're being laughed at or being laughed with, they don't mind. I'm the guy who wants to be laughed with, not laughed at.
Okay.
Right? So that's my funny. So it comes from me just being myself. Sometimes I'll go for it. Sometimes I'll just hold back. But I just be myself. That was my kind of funny.
And what were you doing? Were you like making fun of other people?
We used to have cussing contests.
Okay.
In school. You know, when you get into the playground and your mom's ears are so, you know what I mean? That kind of stuff. To impress girls. It's always to impress girls. No one cared about a cussing contest, but you won a cussing contest. You were the man, at least for that day, you know? Sometimes you lose. And there's not a sad part to it. You never lose to the guy who's funnier than you. You just lose to that guy who was more creative. You know, he just had the composure, you know?
Yeah, the confidence. sense, yeah, the performance,
yeah,
skills.
And he wasn't even a funny guy. He just knew how to get you.
Speaking of someone in whose playground there were no cutting contests, talk me through. That's fascinating to me. Talk me through. Who are these all pre-prepared? Are you coming up with them on the spur of the moment?
It's always a... So guys are hanging around in the playground. It's lunchtime or whatever. We've just finished. Maybe there's no football to play. We're all hanging around. There's girls around. Someone comes, you know, oh, why is your shirt like? Do you know what I mean? And it starts from there. And you can't back down. You know, you have to have the bars. Otherwise, you're just going to look like an idiot the whole year. So you have to just come up with... It's just ways you look at someone, you know? You're just like, oh, your hair is so... who cut your hair? You know, did you go to the barber and say, oh, give me the fuck me up? Do you know what I mean? And I was like, oh, my God. And then you get the hype, man. Like, you need good hype men to win a cussing contest.
Okay.
You need your guys around you to overhype the jokes to make it seem as if you're killing this guy.
Oh, I got it. Yeah. Okay, so like, even
oh
if you're...
Oh, my God!
So your joke only has to be good enough that they can realistically react as if it was incredible.
Yeah, overhype it. And if you have the good hype men, they overhype your jokes, the other guy gets frustrated. When you're angry, you can't cuss. You just can't because you're reaching for it. It's like a fight. You know when you're fighting and you get angry and frustrated, you start hitting so fast and missing your shots. And then you're picked off easily. You can't get personal. You got to back up a bit. When it's getting too hot, you got to say, you know what? I'm losing this one. Let me try and keep my composure. Wait for your moment. But some guys, because of the hype, man, oh, are you going to have that? He said your mom blood. And you're like,
so you need a good. So that's like a real, not even a double act. It's like a group.
Oh, you need a team.
You need a team. So with the hype men, are you guys taking it in turns to be each other's hype?
Oh
men?
No.
Like I mean, generally on different days.
No, because there's only one person that can really cuss. Your crew members don't want. They don't want it. They don't. They just want to back you up. They just want to be around with you. Because sometimes if you're a good guy, if you're good at this, you'd go for some of the hype men. So he's cussing you. You know you're losing to him. Hey, why are you laughing though?
You shift the
focus onto him.
Yeah, okay.
And he can't handle that heat. So he's like, no, well, why are you bringing me in for? And if you can kill him, they'll forget that you've lost to him and go for him. So it's all about picking how you can win this.
I am amazed that no one has turned this into Britain's got cusses. Do you know what I mean? That is absolutely
on the bus home from school. Oh my God. My friend Marlon, he was the king in school. He used to set off on everyone to the point where people would get on the bus. I would get on the bus because I just come back from Nigeria, so I didn't know the runnings yet. I'd been away for a while, so I wanted to observe how it worked before I got back into the game. So I was quiet in school, and so we'd get on the bus and I'd sit like far in the front because I didn't want to get involved in the cussing because he would pick everyone up on the bus. People used to get on the bus just to see him do it. It was like his own show on the back of the bus, just chilling.
What's he doing now? Have you got any idea?
He's one of my closest friends. He's doing music now. I said to him, we should do comedy because we became good friends and we had like a double act going on. So we'd go to like church and stuff like that. People, we and him would be together. We were unstoppable. Like people try and battle us and we were just,
easy. You like, because you were both cussed, do you have your own hype men or would you hype for him? Or
me and him were hype for each other. Him alone was too much. I mean, you'd have your own, you'd have the other team's hype men joining us. They're like, you know what? This is an unstoppable force. Like, we were just incredible. And I remember saying to him, Stuart, I was like, look, we should do stand-up, man. He goes, come on, Fumbi, man. Being funny in front of our friends and whatnot is one thing. But being funny in front of a bunch of people you don't know, come on, man, we can't do that. But we didn't understand the concept of stand-up. Yeah. We just thought it was walk on stage and tell a joke right now. We didn't know there was preparation, there was writing, there was new material.
Yes, and at the same time, whenever you're involved in cussing people, you're improvising loads of stuff.
Way more than a stand-up. Way more. But because you're thinking there's no pressure, and that's the secret behind stand-up. The ability to be able to take those natural moments of yourself and bring it to the stage is what we're trying to find to do. But we think of the whole, oh my God, you know, there's an audience here, it has to be prepared, it has to be written well, it has to be structured, and I have to have this amazing punchline at the end. But in actual fact, you just have to be yourself. Because that's what the cussing contests were about. We didn't have no writing. We didn't have no pre-match. Oh, today I'm going to use this. No, you just hoped you had the right words that day.
I'm going to retire that mum material. It's been seen too much.
There was no worried about, oh my God, I don't hope there's any reviewers in the audience today. You know, there was none of that. It was just, we're going to the playground. People used to look forward to it because it was a natural environment. Sometimes you lose badly. Sometimes you win well.
And what's the emotional fallout of losing badly? Like, how quick can you get over it? It's effectively a bad gig.
Do you know what
right?
it is? It's what I used to hate about it was the guys who were never involved in the contest, who just wanted to rub it on all the time and repeat the jokes in the classroom, like during maths. Oh, you should have been in the playground, man. He said his mum had two noses, blood. And it was like, you know, you're just sitting there hoping for the next day, really. Sometimes you get, if it's a good session where everyone was on the floor, you're not living that down for at least a month. You know, you shouldn't even come to the playground anymore. Just chill out.
Got to be let school. Yeah, you've been expelled. No, yeah, no.
Witness protection program. Like, you need to leave because everyone knows, you know, that you just got rinsed in the playground, you know? Yeah. And that was how a lot of, I was listening to Jamie Foxx at one point, and that's how he came up. He said he used to go to Venice Beach and he'd be there for 3 hours. Going at it. Yeah, with the best of them in the park. People just going at each other. You know, your mum jokes, your dad jokes. People just going at it. It's like a serious roast and you're like, oh my God, you know? And there was never any like animosity, you know? You couldn't take it personal. You need to put your mum into it.
It never turned into violence.
Never. It was always just banter. It was just fun, you know? If it got into violence, everybody knew you're emotional. It's getting to you and you can't handle it. And that was even worse. So you think, oh, you can't handle a bit of jokes. You know what I mean?
It can't kick up, otherwise you can't. Automatically
you just look like an idiot. Like, why are you taking it there? This is just jokes.
And are there any, in that kind of environment, in your school environment, were there any kind of rules as to what was untouchable? Was there anything you couldn't say? Did you ever go too far?
Yeah, of course, you could go too far. You could never talk about someone's mum if they're passed. You know, if their mum was dead, you didn't do that. Unless you're really looking to fight someone, you left that zone alone. But there was nothing really, personals are always great because that's how you get to someone, isn't it? So, you know, if you're like, I fucked your girl, like, everyone starts doing somersaults and everything like that. And you're like, oh, but sometimes, you know, you can't get upset because half of them, we didn't even have girlfriends. You know what I mean?
We were just in school.
You know what I mean? Like, why are you getting upset at that, you know? But yeah, it was that kind of, you couldn't get upset because it's like, you know, when you play FIFA with someone and you're destroying them in their house, on their PlayStation, on their controller, and their next move is, I'm not even playing anymore. And they turn off the computer again. We're like, look at him. Like, come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, right,
man.
Right. That's
like, grow up, man. Like,
so this is Fumby. I mean, what a lovely man. He's an excellent comic and very, very lovely man to spend some time with. I hope you're enjoying this as much as I did. I am going to race through these. I always say that. Today it's true. I've got an awful lot of keeping the family alive stuff to do. I've got some real household tasks bearing down on me, and I am starting to wonder how on earth regular people do it. Now that my job seems to take as much, if not more, time as a regular job, I swear I started doing comedy so that I'd have an easy life. Wasn't that part of the plan, at least somewhere along the way? Wasn't it an alternative to working really hard? Who knows? Very much no longer the case. Couple of things. Thank you for all of your donations. Very much appreciated. It's nice to see those trickle in, particularly those of you who have set up recurring subscription payments via PayPal or Moonclerk. All of the info is at comedianscomedian.com/donate. And thank you as well for the one-off donations that many of you are sending in. I did wonder whether I should, I mean, I never really talk about the numbers. I say, hey, you know, £5, £10, £20, £50, a pound a show, or just the price of a bottle of wine or a baby gift for a trusted friend. We say all those nebulous things before. I've had some one-off crackers recently. A person who I won't name, but who used to be a comedian and has recently completed comedy, donated £100, which that's a very rare occurrence. But every so often, my phone goes ping and a listener has decided to donate £100. So that really is the target to beat if you want to look fly. Thank you so much to that listener. We've been corresponding. And also thank you to everyone who is sending me smaller donations as well. And it's very kind of you. Lots of you say you would like to donate more. There's no need to say that. I take it for granted. But if you are a student or a single parent and otherwise impecunious, then your donations mean all the more to me. And if you're super rich, I mean, Christ, just go for it, fellas. Fellas, I don't know where fellas came from there. I was going to say just go for it, man, and then I thought that's sexist. So instead I said fellas. Well done, Goldsmith. So thanks for all of those. All the information at comedianscomedian.com/donate. A letter now, an email from listener Catherine. She says, I've been listening to your podcast since catching you on Jason Manford's radio show a couple of months back and promised myself I'd donate when I got up to date. So here you go. I don't work in comedy, she says. Ping, gold star. But I was after a distraction to and from work. What I wasn't expecting was for it to be such a thought-provoking listen, and it's actually helped me make sense of the world a little bit, or at least understand that there are a lot of people making sense of the world in their own way, and it doesn't matter if it's fucking hard as long as you're yourself and try or something. And I really appreciate the sentiment, Catherine. Thank you, and for the donation. What I particularly loved
was the fucking and the or something. That's really, it doesn't matter if it's fucking hard, as long as you're yourself and try or something. Can any of us aspire to any more of a mantra than that? Thank you, Katrin. Thank you all for your donations, for your correspondence. Couple of things to promote. I can't spell Schadenfreude, but if you Google it, I'm sure you'll be able to find the Schadenfreude Cabaret, which is running a preview season at the Harrison Pub, very near Euston in central London, about 10-15 minutes walk from Euston. And they have been kind enough to give us a special offer. If you use the code COMCOM at tickettext.co.uk, that's tickettext.co.uk, you can reserve a seat for free. They're free previews, but a lot of them featuring people like Nish Kumar, Simon Munnery, Sam Simmons, and indeed myself, and many, many more. Some of them will fill up, if not sell out, because you can't sell out because they're free. But if you use the code COMCOM at tickettext.co.uk, then you can get a guaranteed free seat. That's quite a good... That's quite a good little marketing ploy, I think, on behalf of the organisers of Schadenfreude Cabaret, because, you know, we're not really flogging anything there, but nonetheless, it does let you guys be part of a select and secret group that get to book things in advance. So go to tickettext.co.uk, there's hundreds and hundreds of previews there. That's a lie, there are tens. There are several tens, but do come along to see those. I think I'm on there Wednesday this week, doubling up with... Can't remember, but I'm looking forward to it. So come along for that, and there will be a bucket at the end of the show if you want to donate. I simply don't approve of buckets. You know my feelings on buckets. It's a hat or nothing. Having said that, I've recently collected money after shows in both a pint glass and my own kind of held up t-shirt, so who am I to talk? There's a lot of ComCom Pod veterans on the bill doing previews at Schadenfreude Cabaret, so look out for them. As far as my own previews go, we've chucked in a last-minute one at Top Secret Comedy Club in Drury Lane. Myself and Rachel Paris are doing a Saturday afternoon preview on July the 9th at 4 o'clock. So come and see me and Rachel. You'll know her from Ostentatious, the brilliant Jane Austen impro show, her own Game of Thrones podcast that I was a guest on earlier in the latest series, and lots of stuff besides her own solo stand-up and musical stand-up stuff, which is absolutely brilliant. Final thing to promo, of course, not only my own Edinburgh show, Compared to What, which is happening at the Liquid Room Annex at 3:45 p.m. Every day of the Edinburgh Festival from the 6th to the 28th, apart from the 15th when I get a sweet day off. So come along and see that. That's a free show as well, but do bring money. And especially, I don't know if I've released this before, this information. If not, then it's a world exclusive. On Tuesdays at 6:40 p.m. during the Edinburgh Festival, there are three Tuesdays as part of Edinburgh, and I've got them all, 6:40 p.m. in the Banshee Labyrinth Chamber Rooms. I mean, that's... I know what all those words mean individually, but you'll have to find them for yourself. I am doing the Comedian's Comedian podcast, Redacted. So come and see a special off-the-record sort of format-gasm of various little ideas that I'm going to be playing around with. I mean, some of them are really quite cruel ideas, but they're going to be interesting. I think the idiom of this show is to find ways of really getting, like, you know the bits where I go to my guest, we say, oh, we'll talk about that after the recording. It's sort of about those bits. It's a means of trying to access and dig into some people's opinions about comedy that they're less happy sharing in a recorded format. So come and see ComCom Redacted. Three shows only, 6:40 p.m. for free in the Banshee Labyrinth Chamber Rooms on Tuesdays throughout the festival. That's all for now. Keep your donations and your correspondence coming into info@comedianscomedian.com. Do keep sharing the show with your friends, and thank you as well for a lot of love for the Shappy Corsandi episode. I think you'll agree we're on top form at the minute. There have been some belters recently, but if you've not caught up with the Shappy one, it's particularly timely given the horror of Brexit. Now, let's get back to Fumbi Omoteo. Do you remember the first moment when you thought, this isn't just in the playground, this isn't just in college, there's, like... What was the first time when you went, maybe there's, I can do this for a job?
You know what?
And I need never change another light bulb.
You know what? I was in college one day and they were playing this song. I was in college one day and I was just joking. I was in the canteen, college canteen. I used to do all my jokes in the green room. And I was just joking about Nigerians. And I was just going in, because I used to live in Nigeria. I know Nigerians. I was just joking about them. And these two Nigerians in the corner, and they didn't like it. And they thought I was just being rude. And they were going to beat me up. But they were just, I don't know, they just were wasted. They didn't choose that day. And so like a week later, I'm in the canteen again. They're playing this song and I'm doing these jokes to this song and they're laughing in the corner. These two guys that wanted to beat me up, they're laughing their ass off in the corner. And then they come up to me afterwards and like, man, you're funny. I was like, oh, thanks. We were going to beat you up. And I was like, why? Because you were cussing Nigerians, but we didn't know you were this funny. And they left me. And that's when I realized I might have something here. Can I make people laugh to the point where they don't have to kill me? Wow, that's interesting.
Because that's probably harder than making people laugh to the extent where they just give you money.
Yeah.
Like if you can do the comedy to stay alive.
Yes, to stay alive.
A career.
Exactly, just to live, you know. I was just surprised that, you know, I was okay. But I didn't think of it. I hadn't discovered stand-up then. You know, I didn't think of it career-wise. I didn't know most of my favorite comedians did stand-up, like Eddie Murphy, Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle. I didn't know they came from a stand-up medium.
You just knew them as film stars.
Movie stars, yeah. And so it didn't click then. It didn't click until I went on stage for 5 minutes. And
when
I
your realized, sister booked
yeah,
you this game.
It didn't click until, and even then, Stuart, man, I was like, because For when it's a predominantly black audience, it's a different feeling. When you're performing on the main circuit and it's comedy rooms and they're comedy, you know, when you say you have a comedy audience, an audience that knows what happens in a comedy club, it's different from like a corporate gig. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
They're not there for comedy. They're there for whatever. And then you're just a comedian. Whereas a comedy audience are there for you. So they know how it works. With the urban circuit, it was a very new thing to black people. So it was almost like prove to us you're funny.
Okay.
You know, it was like the Apollo in America, where they want to boo you. Like, that's what they're there for. To them, that's part of the entertainment.
Okay.
Someone getting booed off stage.
Okay, so paint the picture for us then. This first, for anyone that's not been to an urban circuit gig, what kind of, how big, I get the impression they're pretty big rooms. I mean, well, I see around London, I'll see posters with like the big names like Slim, Felicity, Ethnic, Kojo, and you just get the impression that it's like, oh, if they've bothered postering this, this is going to be 1,000 people.
Shepherd Bush Empire,
yeah,
right? When it first started, it was at Cork's Wine Bar, which was in Bond Street near Selfridges, right? And Kojo had Cork, it was in the basement, right?
Okay.
And that's when I first understood about rooms in comedy. And it's this basement. And when I first did it, it wasn't busy.
So when you say when it first started, you mean your...
When I first, 2004, yeah. Because in 2004 it started and it wasn't as popular. So it's about, with my family, there's about 20 people in the audience.
Okay, right? Okay.
And I did that I did my first 5 minutes in like, what, May? And it lost its number and I came back in August. When I came back in August, it had doubled to like 200 people.
Okay.
It just, word of mouth had just traveled. So on its best days, Cork's, I think the capacity was 200.
Okay.
On a good night, one good night, we had 400 in there. People jumped the fire escape and came in. It was going to happen.
Okay.
And you come into this room and it's hip hop blasting. You walk in, you walk down the stairs, you know, and then you open the doors and it's like boom, 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 boom. And you just know you have to be on your A game here tonight.
Okay, okay. Now, so how many acts are on the bill?
So Cold used to open with Poet. And then you have two comics who are established in the first half. You have a break. Then you have the new guy for 5 minutes. And then you have an established guy.
Okay.
So my second night, Paul Childy was on after me. Mm-hmm. And so he was, you know, the main guy that night. And you walk into this room and it's basement, you know, bashment, music, everything just going loud. And there's girls everywhere. And that's another thing, okay? Girls attract guys. So guys come because they've heard there's so many girls. So everyone's looking nice, you know?
Okay.
You do not want to die on stage tonight.
Okay, okay, It's rather not more at stake than... I'm trying to think of an equivalent gig on the mainstream circuit.
Right.
I don't know what
it's
the equivalent
situation
is. It's
like performing for Don. Like, he's going to give you another 10 minutes at the Comedy Store.
Yes,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
having that in your head.
Okay.
But this one is more of like, you're not just thinking of comedy. You're thinking, man, if I die here tonight, how am I going to talk to anybody, you know?
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever done this on a stage and you've had a good gig and you don't know where to go after. You're like, thanks guys, you just want to kind of disappear, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And when you have a bad gig, it's kind of like the same thing as well. I just want to disappear. And you walk down that thing and then, you know, you're there, you're ready. Kojo goes on, he introduces the night. Everyone's in laughing mood. He's got the crowd really warmed up. You know, everyone's in the zone. And Cork's was, there was no stage. It was the floor. And the crowd was right in front of you.
And this is your first stand-up gig?
This is not my first stand-up gig. This is how it was when I started. My first one was more relaxed.
Okay.
Cole just said I was going on. He told me the format. Because I called him before. He said two comics on in the first half. I do a break. I come back on. Warm them up even more. Then you do 5 minutes. So at that time, they'll be in laughing mode. and then I have a close. I was like, you know what, that's perfect. That sounds, I can trust that.
Okay.
I get there on the day, he says, listen, someone's pulled out, I need to put you on first. So I looked at him, I said, what does first mean? is there a new meaning to first? I don't know.
Is that like an industry term? Yeah.
Like a comedy.
You mean like first after the first ten?
You know what I mean? He goes, no, I mean to put you on first. I pulled him to the side. I said, I can't go on first. He said, why? No, I said, it's my first time. You said there'll be two comics, a break, then you and me. I stuck that to my format. That's what's been in my head all night. Can we please do that? He's like, no, look, you'll be fine. Don't worry. Just go out there, do your thing. I said, okay. My friend was the poet on first. He did this poem. I went on. My family was in the audience, which was good. It definitely helped. And I learned my first lesson in comedy. Never take the mic away from your mouth.
I mean, there's beginner mistakes and then there's not talking into the mic. I know, it's so easy to forget, right? You're in the headlights of the crowd, everyone's staring at you.
You just think, I can do, this is just talking, right?
Yeah.
I took the mic away and said something. Everyone's like, huh? I'm like, whoa, okay, this thing on, you know? And I learned that straight away. Okay. You know, always keep the mic to your mouth, because once you take that away, unless you're yelling, as part of the act, they're never going to understand.
And had you written jokes for this? Had you prepared stuff?
When I was in Canada, I went to drama school in Canada.
Okay.
I went to drama school in Canada.
It's more of your secret life.
I know. I went to drama school in Canada before I even went to drama school in London. So I went to drama school in Canada to get away from, you know, my friends in trouble and just, you know, start fresh. And in Canada, they told us to do a stand-up set as part of the course.
Gotcha.
So we had to do one in class. And it was awful, my set. I can't write, Stuart. I can't write my material down. I just talk and I leave it in my head and I play with it until I find the rhythm.
Okay.
And so when I went home that night, I wrote an entire set in my book. Just wrote all the jokes I could think of at that time. So that was what I took to the comedy stores. 5 minutes, I chopped it down. I think I spoke about R. Kelly and growing up in London as a Nigerian. That was my shtick.
Okay.
And, you know, the black people versus white people stuff. You know, the from Def Jam. That was my school of comedy, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, this is the way. So, I did that. You know, I went on. I wrote the jokes. I did my set. And it was good. But the feelings I had before of it, I thought to myself, no man should have to go through that just to perform. You know, stomach flipping. And I was tired and I was strong and I was sitting down. I was nervous. And I just thought, maybe comedy's not for me, you know. And I did my 5 minutes and I just left it.
Okay.
I didn't understand anything about stand-up.
That was your first, when you went on first?
When I went on first, situation. Yeah. Okay. I didn't understand anything.
Did you get some laughs?
Oh, I got loads of laughs. And it was a routine. I mean, it was a good routine. It's just that I didn't understand comedy. I thought that was it. I thought once you've done your jokes, you can't ever do them again. I didn't realize there's so many more people on earth for me. You know, they need to hear it too. But I was like, I can't do these jokes no more. They're done. They've been good. I move on from me. Okay. So I went back to drama school. But then I got kicked out of drama school. They didn't keep me on for the second year because they were like, you know, the work, I was losing the intensity in my work because I was just working so hard at Harrods and I was just tired. And even drama school was hard.
You were a porter at Harrods doing
doing the pallets.
Okay.
Yeah. Harrods is amazing.
That was a beautifully East London pronunciation of pallets.
Yeah, the pallets. And so then after I got kicked out of drama school, I was like, I'm down to my last options again. It's either light bulb or try and do this comedy thing. So I just said, okay, let me go back. Let me try and do it again. Called Kojo for another 5 minutes. And he was like, I've been looking for your number. Where you been? And by the time I came back to that comedy club, and I thought I was nervous the first night. When I came back the second night and he had over 200 people in there, I was like, I don't want to do this at all. You know? And this time he didn't put me on first, thankfully. He put me on in the second half. And that was the first night I felt I could do something. I had the routines, I had the flows. At that time, a lot of the comedy was banter between Nigerians and Jamaicans.
Yes.
So every Jamaican comic will come on and destroy Nigerians. And it'd be so easy and everyone loved it. And this goes back to school days because we were the inferior ones in school. But now there's a lot of Nigerians, so we had a voice. So when they were doing the whole Nigerian stuff, everybody in the comedy club who was Nigerian was tapping me. Like, when you go on from B, make sure you represent us, you know. And I was like, I didn't plan.
What with this being gig number two? Yeah. You really got to represent. You know? You're here for your whole country.
Like, really? And I'm just sitting there thinking, and you know what? I didn't prepare any Jamaican jokes. I had this routine I was going to do that was going to be 5 minutes. I had it structured and everything. But everyone was like, you got to go on. Come on, they're dissing us, man. You're just going to leave us out there. I was like, all right, good. So I added this little intro that that I was going to do to, you know, give Nigerians back their face or whatever.
Yeah.
I do that. It works. What happens? I forget my train of thought because it wasn't part of the set. And you know, in your mind, you set the jokes up so that everything's like a link. So you can just flow, so I don't have to think of where I'm going next.
Yeah, and then of course you forget one joke and suddenly the chain's broken.
The chain's ruined. So I forget and I go blank on stage to it. And I learned my second lesson in comedy. Never panic when you go blank on stage.
Okay.
Relax. If you panic, it's game over. So I just took a deep breath and I actually said it to the audience. I said, oh man, I forgot what I was going to say. And someone said, oh, and I pulled out an imaginary tissue paper from my pocket. It was tissue. Wrote nothing on this tissue, by the way. Looked and goes, oh, there it is. And I just started talking again. There was nothing on that piece of tissue.
Okay.
Nothing written at all. But I just knew I need to gather myself.
Sure.
And I need to find it and then carry on. Because the sharks were waiting. Everyone was leaning like, oh, shit, here we go, here we go. But I managed to save it. I went on too long. And Kojo was not happy about that because I went on way longer than I was supposed to. I didn't realize time. Again, all these things you're learning. Mm-hmm. You know, a 5-minute routine is a 5-minute routine. Just because it's going well doesn't mean she's staying there for the rest of the night.
Yeah, to be fair, if this is your second gig, you've only just got your head around holding the mic towards your mouth. Yes, yes, kind of understandable. You might need a flash.
You know, and then, you know, poor Chowdhury went on and you know, he went on and did his thing. And Kojo told me something very interesting that night. He said to me, he said, listen, don't go over your time. Always leave them wanting something more. You know, and which is really good. A good comedian knows when to come off. I've seen so many comics who get that big laugh at the end of a routine, you know, and they think, you know what? Wow, that was a good laugh. Let me try and get another one. And you won't get that other one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I noticed that a lot with the Americans. American comics they don't do any of this kind of like put the mic back in the stand. I'll tell you this before I leave kind of stuff that for some reason loads of British comics do. Americans tend to go, that's the punchline. That's the bigger punchline. That's the fever pitch punchline. That's You've been great, mate.
And a lot of urban comics didn't realize that. They thought the idea of a good gig is I just keep killing it. You know, everyone just keeps, but the idea of a good, for me anyway, the idea of a good routine and a good gig is when you know that that's enough. You know, I've done this great stuff and I've told this story here, that story there. I've got this last punchline and let them want to look for you after that. So you know what? I got to hear more of this guy, you know, and I had to learn that, you know, in that 5-minute routine,
yes,
which was a good experience, you know, a good lesson. And then after that, I got more comfortable and understanding how to do comedy.
Okay.
And then I got nominated that year for the best newcomer award at the Black Entertainment Awards. Now you have to remember, I hadn't been awarded for anything. You know, I was just like, whoa, this is great. You know, I'm going to get awarded if I won. And we had this whole voting thing, you know, everyone was getting involved and it was at the Hackney Empire and I won that night, and it just changed my whole, that's when I started to think, well, I thought anyway, that maybe I could do something with this, but I didn't understand the industry, and I still didn't understand comedy, I didn't understand routines, I didn't understand how to progress, and how to make this actually a career, and that's what I had to learn, and that's why I was on there for 8 years, because it got too comfortable.
So you were making a living from it?
Yeah, well, the not money's a living, okay. I was working part-time. The money's incredible.
That's kind of what I was hinting at.
The consistency of the shows isn't.
Oh, I see.
So you see, the thing is, Stuart, on the main circuit, yeah, you do gigs every single day. When I started doing the main circuit in 2012, I was still raw, rough around the edges. And I'm not saying I'm the finished article now, but I'm 10 times better than I was in 2012. That's because of constant gigging. On the urban circuit, I could do a show in January, one big show at the Indigo too. And I'm making, what, £400 for a 20-minute set.
Okay.
That won't be 20 minutes, by the way. They'll come up to you towards the end of the show and be like, listen, man, we've run over time. Can you do a quick 5?
Yeah.
And okay, you're like, yeah. Oh, man, I have so much to say in this 15 minutes, but hey, if it's 5 I'll for bring £400, it I'll keep it down. And you're not growing, you know? And you know, the urban circuit gave me everything I had in terms of performance, stage persona. Because if you can handle a black room full of black people, you can go onto any stage at least. Because it's really.
Good. Talk to me specifically about that. When you say it's really. What's the difference in.
Right. You've seen Def Jam, right?
Yes, I have.
Right. When you walk on that stage, there was a Def Jam with Bernie Mac, and he comes on, and his first line is,
I ain't afraid of you.
I ain't afraid of you,
man,
motherfuckers.
That's the best routine.
The reason why he did that was because. Yes. Before he came on, they had booed every single comic.
I had heard that.
And Stuart, I'm not talking boo. I'm talking boo. Like, you stole my money, boo. You know? Like, this is personal, boo. And so everybody was terrified. And so Bernie Mac, they were even saying to Bernie, look, you don't have to do it tonight. They're clearly not in the mood. He's like, no, I'm not going to just be afraid of them. And that's why it comes out. And it's almost like you have to fight for your respect.
That routine, you don't understand. I ain't scared of you, motherfuckers. Yeah, that is an incredible. I would urge anyone listening to
honestly,
this to press pause and watch on YouTube. That,
yeah, because you're just watching it and how a man wins an audience. Patrice O'Neill used to do that. He would say they used to come on, piss the audience off, and try and win them over. Stuart, I would never try that.
Yeah,
I want them to love me as soon as I walk on.
So is that so? In the UK urban circuit, it's informed by Def Jam. Why? Because the audiences have been watching Def Jam, or because the promoters have been watching Def Jam setting it up like that.
Yeah, the audience have been watching Def Jam. Remember, when it's a black comedy room, it's got the hip hop music. It's got the loud hip hop music. So everyone's in a party mood. Everyone's in a good mood. Everyone's in good vibes. But I won't say they're hard to impress. I just feel like they demand more. You know, it's almost like when you come on that stage, you have to be able to make us belly laugh. And when you make them belly laugh, they give it up. I mean, I've seen chairs move in an urban comedy club. You know, from the punchline, you're just like, I'm a rock star.
And is there a breadth of styles on the urban circuit in the same way as there is, like, are you going to get one line of comics and absurdist?
I think that was the only problem. The culture of comedy wasn't they didn't know the culture of comedy, so they wanted haymakers from the jump. You know, they didn't want a nice decent story, you know, that's going somewhere, or a one-liner comic, or an observation. You know, some comics who are quirky and stuff like that, where if I go on the mainstream, they give them time to, you know, develop and get to, oh, I get what he's doing there. On the urban scene, there was no real room for that. You know, they were so accustomed to people knocking the mic out, it was like you had to bring that. Oh, don't come, you know? So there was no storytellers. It was just straight boom, boom, boom. There's a lot of, you know, black people do this, white people do that. A lot of Nigerians do this, Jamaicans do that.
Yeah, and when you say as well, Nigerian, Jamaicans, you mentioned on one of the clips that I saw of one of your of an urban circuit gig was you did a thing about Ghanaians as well.
Yeah.
So there are presumably a whole broad range of stereotypes of different...
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what we milked. And if you can imagine, if you were Ghanaian and you had a Ghanaian comedian who did a joke about Nigerians that was so good that everybody laughed, you could own Ghana the next day. Like, people would love you for it. You know, anything you could. I had this joke.
Are those the three main groups? Are there other...
So it was Nigerians... The main groups were Nigerians and Jamaicans, because we're the biggest nations in our continents.
Gotcha.
Right? And so we had the most numbers. And no one likes us because we're arrogant. It's like the English. We're the loud... The Welsh don't like us. They don't like us because we're the biggest, we're the loudest. You know, it's that kind of feeling. And... So you had Nigerians in the room. So you had a lot of Nigerians in the office, you know, in the room. You'd have like at least 100. Then you have at least another 100 Jamaicans, and then like the rest were Ghanaians, whatever you want. And the rivalry from Nigeria and Jamaica came from school days. Yeah. And we were at the back foot all the time. So now you have a platform where we can just go out and say, gotcha, look at you Jamaicans and blah, blah, and everyone's laughing from the belly. They're like, wow, this is incredible.
So did you find, something you alluded to earlier on, did you find that it was... After those 8 years on the circuit, do you still do black circuit gigs at the moment?
Not as much.
Not as much. So why is that? You've lost the taste for it? Is it less of a...
If I'm honest with you, Stuart, as much as I, you know, as much as some of the gigs were great moments, you know, I feel like there's no development.
Okay.
And we have to develop. We have to do better as comics, you know. You see on TV today, everyone's talking about diversity and you need more black people on TV and stuff like that. And it's not a case of more black people on TV. You'd like in more shows involving black people, but it also has to, it's both ways, you know. We have to be prepared as well to put out good content, you know, to put out good work. And a lot of the times on the urban circuit, when you do the shows, the material suffered a lot, you know. You had people thinking, just because I'm Nigerian, I could be a comedian. You know, and egos came in. So you do your first show and it's at the Hackney Empire. You get 1,000 people laughing. You think you're Chris Rock. Next thing you know, you're calling that same person. He's got an agent. You know, no, a real agent, just his buddy. You know, okay. He's charging, he's doing £700 a show. And you're like, you just saw his first show yesterday. You're like, you know. And so no one really knew about the material aspect of comedy, you know, where it was, you're only as good as your content. You know, if you're not, and also as well, we were popular for selling out big venues. So, you know, Hackney Empire, the Indigo too. And that was great. It's good progression. But the content lacked. And my thing is always, you never talk about the venue a great comedian played. You always relay what he said. You know, the Bill Hicks, the Carlins, the Chris Rocks. No one cares what venue they played. You quote that material, you know, that game changing, that thought process. Like, wow, how did he get to that punchline? And none of us didn't have that. And that was never going to work.
So what bits from your black circuit material are examples? Was there anything in there that you felt like this is the beginning of, like, because that's something I talk about in the show a lot, is legacy, the idea of having a joke that people will be quoting 50 years from now.
Right.
Did you? And I'm not sort of asking to what funny stuff we're going to be quoting 50 years from now. But obviously, if you started to feel like there's something more out there, I'm not satisfied with coming out and doing. I mean, I don't. Is generic the right word?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of like those haymakers.
Yeah.
From the jump, as I'll be saying from now on.
From the jump.
But what stuff did you have that you started to think, this could be a bit, this could be like a signature bit rather than just more?
Well, again, I never thought of it like that. I just knew I was funny. I had this joke when I would say, because we used to want to be Jamaicans when we were in school, like when we were a kid, because Africans weren't cool. And I said, my name wasn't even Fumbi, it was Fumbert. And it was such a quotable joke. People used to call me Fumbert. They loved that joke and it was quotables. Now, just thinking to myself, wow, people would message me, yo, Fumbert, man, we just say that in my school all day. So I was just like, wow, I mean, this is it's interesting. People are quoting this joke. I didn't even know it was that funny, you know?
Yeah, okay.
And so I started to think of it in that sense then, like, why is that happening, you know? And then you start, it was only when I started doing the mainstream, I realized how you do bits, I just left that Fumbert joke at that. You know, but I didn't know about expanding on that. Yeah. Maybe making Fumbert a character, even, you know, who comes on as Fumbert. I didn't think of it like that. Only until I got to the mainstream. On the urban scene, it was more of a case of popularity. It was more popularity than you had urban comics who had 10,000 followers on Twitter. 10,000 followers on Twitter. And they're not even writers or anything like that. They're just doing urban shows, you know? And so the popularity aspect of the industry, of the urban circuit, was great. But again, it was just, I always used to say it was hype over substance.
Okay.
A lot more hype than there was substance. And eventually hype dies down and you need substance to keep you there.
Okay, so just to continue this analogy of you doing the cuss battles at school with your hype men.
Yeah.
The audiences on that circuit, you felt, were just like a hype man audience. They were just loving it. They were just exploding the way that you didn't think you were earning.
Yeah, but then eventually they would want more. So you just get the audience saying, this whole Nigerian Jamaican thing is getting a bit played out now.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? Like, they started to see through it and they wanted more. And you know what I mean? So it became a thing where it was like, this is just not enough. It's not enough to just come out and be Nigerian. And I was disappointed in myself to come out and get away with a show just because I'm Nigerian. So now I'm gonna have to work on my material or work on my punchlines. I just knew.
Just doing it all on kind of charisma.
Yeah. And okay. That's what I worked on a lot, my charisma. Yeah. I just knew. Come out, like, you know when your mom used to, and then just run off that. I didn't have to worry about that. But then at the same time, as I started to get older, I started to have more opinions. Like, I'd have a routine about the London riots and stuff like that and find punchlines in that. And I started to realize that my audiences were almost maybe immature, because it was like, you know, a lot of uni crowds. So maybe they didn't really have the focus points. They were more interested in, you know, social media and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I just knew I'm going to have to do something different to progress.
So had you seen, what was the first mainstream gig that you went to?
Up the Creek in Greenwich.
Okay.
Shout out to Polly and David Gelly. Yeah. Polly McGraw and David Gelly. Polly, funny club, thing is, but you know what? I went there just after the World Cup. And they did a routine there and I didn't like it. Now, this is the thing, Stuart. This is what comics know. You die on Monday, you get back on Tuesday. I died on Thursday, didn't come back till next year. I said, you know what? The urban scene treats me way better than this. You know, I was too afraid.
Yeah, well, once you're in a situation of being effectively, like, were you a headliner on the Black Circuit?
I was the man. Well, yeah.
I can see you're going to be ringing me tomorrow going, can we dial back some of the claims I have made?
My name was good. People knew who I was.
Yeah.
I was getting stopped in the streets. People were like, oh my God, I love you. I did a one-man show I cat for the theatre. I was good. But one thing I loved about everything was I was never satisfied. Inside, I knew I'm lying to myself. Because my favorite comics were Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle, and I watched their material and I put mine to the test and it just didn't add up. And I'm just like, I know there's more than this. Then I watched Jerry Seinfeld do stand up. Now, a lot of people don't, you know, have their opinions on Jerry Seinfeld, but what I loved about him was how he set up a joke about something he just thought was funny and how he got to his punchlines from there. Because, you know, every comedian has something to learn from, whether you think they're funny or not. And so I realized I'm doing something wrong. There must be more.
You're not following,
I'm doing.
What you're saying about Jerry Seinfeld is that he was finding a way to make things he thought were funny, funny for everyone else, rather than pandering
to an audience.
Yeah, okay,
that's the key. You know, you can't pander. You know, I think my brother told me a quote once. He said, "An entertainer gives the audience what they want." an artist gives them what they need. You know, entertainers come on and they satisfy the crowd. It's great. But when you're that artist, when you're that guy, you give them what they didn't even come for. And they're like, wow, I didn't even expect that. And that's how you win.
And that must be one of the hardest things about streams, if you like, to know that if you do a 5-minute open spot to 10 other comics in God knows where, some little London mainstream, you know, inverted commas, mainstream circuit, where there's, I mean, presumably a few more people doing it, more competition, a bit harder to get gigs. And so you do a gig there, and then you're on the bus on the way home, like someone who couldn't then decide to go, I'm just going to ring someone and book myself a big, Catford Theatre gig somewhere else. It must be hard not to revert.
Of course.
To go, stuff this. I made the wrong decision. I'll go back and do what I know.
Of course. A lot of the urban comics, I tell them all the time, jump on the mainstream. It's hard. It's hard to go from people loving you to people not understanding what you're talking about. You know, like, they don't get these references. And that's where the comic had to come out.
Do you know what? I think this might be completely wrong. I feel like it's similar to, have you ever done Comedy Club for Kids? Yeah, what is that face? What's that expression?
Because kids, man, I'd be scared as hell.
Yes, that's why so few people do it.
Yeah.
It's a similar sort of jump where you go from, I can absolutely master this room in this crowd, and it's just a whole different ball game. And you go, it just puts you right back to being an open spot. I don't fancy being vulnerable again.
No, and you know what it is, Stuart? Comics. Being vulnerable, you know, it's beautiful when you see comics you see on TV and you see them still being vulnerable at a gig they're not sure of, you know, if they've not been to in a while. I saw Jack Whitehall at Top Secret, and you know, I hadn't seen him since, because I did his show, TNT show, back in the day. I hadn't seen him since, and I was like, how you doing, man? You good? You just trying some stuff? He goes, yeah, you know, you gotta work this muscle. You could see in his face, this is a TV guy, he's gonna walk out and they're gonna love him anyway. But he still had that respect, you know, that vulnerability of like, you know what, yeah, I'm Jack Whitehall, but I can go out there and they'll be like, oh, you're not that funny anyway. And that's, you need to have that. On the urban circuit, it was going. I didn't have that vulnerability.
So talk to me then about the difference between, so how long, sorry, but I'm just going to get in the timeline. So
sure.
You did the Amused Moose. So you started doing new act competitions.
I went on Top of Creek in 2012. And I remember, so in 2011, I didn't like the set. So I bottled it and I didn't come back. Then I had to make a decision, Stuart. It was like, you know, look, either you do this or you don't, you know? Either you do this or you don't. And so I went down there, booked another 5 minutes. My brother told me one thing. Stop looking at the audiences as black or white. Just look at them as an audience and talk to them on a level that everyone can relate to. And you'll be fine. So thankfully, the Olympics was big at the time.
Yep.
So I just wrote a whole routine about the Olympics. Took it, had 5 minutes, took it to the creek. And Polly, when I walked in, she was like, hi, you've been here before. And I was like, yeah, because you've seen the name Fumbi, right? You've done the math and realized there's only one Fumbi. No, she goes, you've been here before. And I was like, yeah. She goes, thanks for coming again. I didn't realize what she meant was, I remember you from last time. I thought she just meant you're Fumbi because I can see by the name.
And
I was like, you know, you've been here before. I've seen you perform here. But I was like, oh, yeah. She goes, yeah, thanks for coming back. Put me on. It was a competition that night.
Okay.
I came for 5 minutes of material. She goes, this is a competition, by the way. And I'm like, are you serious? 13 acts. I was like, second to last. That's comedy, Stuart, man. 13 acts in a basement, in up the creek, 7-8 people in the audience. I mean, I'm used to walking into a room with black people and it's a club. You can have a rave after this, you know? And I was like, yeah, this is, it's scary, but I feel alive now. I go on stage, try my 5 minutes. I end up winning that night. And I come back for the finals and I win in the final. Then I said, okay, I'm just going to enter all these competitions. 5 was decent. And use that to, you know, see what I can do. Enter the Muse Moose. And you remember, again, a lot of the times when I was doing the urban circuit and I was trying to find myself as a comedian, that fear, that vulnerability, that uncertainty always crept in. Like, I'd book myself into new material nights and I'd bottle it. I'm like, no, I can't do it. I'm not ready for it. I don't have the jokes. I'm not funny enough. But then I had to stop doing that. And so I entered all the competitions. And that's when I started to understand how you stretch out jokes, how you can write more, how you can find more in a great punchline. And then I started putting a routine together. And before I knew it, I had a decent 10 minutes.
I've got to ask, did you feel a bit of a ringer turning up at a new material act, knowing that you've sold out your own show before?
This is the thing, though. This is the thing, and it's the interesting part. Nobody paid attention to the urban circuit. Nothing you did on the urban circuit was even seen as valid. No one even knew who I was on the mainstream. It's only if I told them that have done the urban circuit that they'll be like, oh wow, okay, yeah, I've heard about that circuit. And plus, none of the material I used on the urban circuit could even transcend.
Well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about the difference in in material.
Yeah.
And the difference in your... I think the most apparent thing to me watching your two or three different gigs that are on YouTube, from a Comedy Store set to a gig from 2008, I think it was, Black Circuit gig. You are on the Black Circuit gigs, you are so much more animated.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this, because it's very
Stuart,
engaging.
Man, how do you know my secret? You know what it is, Stuart. Yeah, and this is, you know, I feel comfortable talking with you. You know, this is a good podcast. I want to shout that out. You know, it's really good. It's just a case of when you grow up in growing up in England and just being a minority, you always feel, I guess, around Black people, you feel like you can be yourself. Around other races, you feel like you're an ambassador for Black people. So you don't want them to leave thinking the stereotypes. You want them to leave thinking the right things. So when I'm in front of Black people, I'm just myself, you know. And I'm getting better at it. I'm getting better at being myself. But I'm in front of Black people, I am myself. I'm Fumbi. I can switch to the street slangs. You know, I can say whatever because I know they're gonna get it. It's gonna rock. It's gonna be good. Whereas in front of white people, it's a predominantly white audience. I do put on the professional jacket. I'm a professional comedian. They're gonna understand my jokes. It's not going to be all essence of Fumbi, you know, and I'm breaking that gradually.
That's something you're kind of working towards.
It's something, I'm trying to be honest about, you know, because like it does throw you when you walk into a room and you're predominantly white people. You're the only Black person there, and you know that's why I always started just set with, you know, you guys ready for the ethnic part of the show, just to break the ice. Let's get that out of the room and let me just try and do me. And I'm getting there. When I first started, no way, I wasn't even close. I was this other guy doing stand up, you know. Whereas now I've been able to just relax more, not worry about what's going on, and just try and be a comedian, you know?
Is there, and I'm guessing, and tell me if I'm on difficult territory, is there an element to which you don't want to be too Def Jam in front of a white audience?
Oh my God.
Because you'll feel like you're conforming to what we're expecting.
And you know, there is an element of that. And you just want to, because you know, funny is different in different levels. Whereas I grew up on Def Jam, and I loved Def Jam for what it was when it was then. But I did realize a lot of the comics were just one trick ponies. It didn't take, when I started doing comedy properly and I'd watch Def Jam, even though I love it for nostalgia reasons, I know why that comic isn't progressing, because I'm like, you know what, that's just not going to last. You're going to need more than that in the real world. You know, you look at the Chris Rocks and the Dave Chappelle's, their material is not, you ever fuck a girl so hard she pass out? It's just not that, you know. There's more to it, you know. I watch Mike Epps special on Netflix, and he's almost 50, I guess, in his 40s, and he's coming out and he's opening up, where the weed at? And you're like, really? At 40? Come on, man. Do you have more than that? And that's what I didn't want. So you're right. There is that idea of like, you don't want to be a Def Jam comedian. You want to be a comedian who people respect your content. You know, you provoke thought. People leave that set thinking, oh, I didn't know that, as opposed to I expected that, you know. And that's what I always try to avoid. Before I got on, I read every single review on Trottle of every Black comedian.
That's interesting. What did you glean from that?
You know what? Everybody talks about...
You can speak as delicately as you want here. This is fine.
Everybody talks about... I forget his name, the reviewer.
Steve Bennett.
Everyone talks about him. Everyone was talking about him. It's funny because everyone says he doesn't know what he's talking about, but you want that review in Troll.
Absolutely right. For those of you listening, for people listening to this who are unfamiliar with this, there's a particular comedy website called Chortle. And when, I think it's fair to say, when you are a new comic,
oh my God,
you believe that it is the be all and end all.
It's
and I remember talking about it years ago. I can't believe we've been doing the podcast for years. years ago, I remember like my kind of, the way I see that website is the only problematic thing with it really is that it's the only one, or it was the only one. There's loads more now, but it was the only one. Mm-hmm. So it's not the fault of anyone that runs it, but if it's the only source of information for comedy, he's the only person trying to review everyone, then his review suddenly seems far more important than
what it actually was. Yeah. And so I read all the reviews, and it hurt in the sense of what he was saying had some substance. You know, he said a lot of them had stage presence, but no real content. And that was the truth, you know.
So you're a post-Chortle Black comic.
Yeah, I am. And I said to myself, even if not what he's saying is completely true, or maybe he's a bit harsh at saying it. I said, rather than me saying, no, man, I don't know what he's talking about, he's a dickhead, blah, 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 let me just try and, you know, take both ends of the stick, bring the stage presence, and try and bring the material. And in fairness to Steve, when he did write about me, this is exactly what he said, you know? And so, that's, but I just didn't want to come out as everybody else did. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to make sure I understood what I was trying to do. I wanted to have, I wanted my content to be much better than me being cool on stage, you know? I wanted to people to come up and say, that joke there made me think. And that's what I wanted, you know? And that's what I worked for. That's why I read all those reviews. That's why I took my time before I jumped on. Because I didn't want to be that guy, you know, just doing comedy because it's cool and, you know, the Def Jam thing and you get girls after the show. That wasn't for me. I wanted people to genuinely laugh because I love Chris Rock. I love how he makes people think. And if I like him as a comedian, I would emulate what he does. I love Bill Hicks, you know.
So what in your own material at the moment, what's the bit of material that you're most excited about that you feel like you've got the beginnings of the next phase of you?
You know what? I'm talking a lot about my identity, being British and Nigerian, you know, having Nigerian parents, growing up in Britain, having, you know, experience in Britain. Like, for instance, my mum, this is the part I'm working on now. My mum is blaming Eastern Europeans for the crime in Dagenham and, you know, the jobs. And she's like, you know, they've come here and they're ruining the neighborhoods. I'm like, mum, remember when that was us? You know, and it's just an amazing thing to see that now we are looking down on people. It's like, really? Oh, we're there now. And I'm trying to explore those avenues of that aspect of Britain now, where it's like, you know, they feel almost as British as the people who are moaning about, you know, refugees or whatever. They feel that connection now. So I'm trying to talk about that because, again, everything I speak about is from my experiences and from how I grew up in this country. A lot of people don't know, like, for instance, the Black Circuit. People didn't even know there was, you know. Why would there be a Black Circuit? There's an Asian circuit. I did an Asian gig for 100 Asians the other day.
I got to admit, I did not know there was an Asian circuit.
Where are you guys?
Who's working on the Asian circuit?
Exactly. But he consistently calls me saying, I'm doing this gig here, I'm doing that gig there. And it's another thing that maybe I should try and discuss on stand-up is, like, why are these rooms? Why do these rooms exist, you know? Is funny not funny? Can we not all just laugh together? But people genuinely feel I'm not going to get me if I go there. But if I go here with a bunch of Paul Chowdhury's and all the other Asian comics, Imran and all that, I'm going to get me. I'm going to get my stuff out. I'm going to hear my stuff, you know? Same as Nigerians. You have Nigerian comedy galas in London where they sell out the Indigo, which is 2,000 people, and it's sold out. And these shows are like 8 hours long. Like 400 comics. I'm exaggerating. But so many comedians, entertainers and everything, these people pay good money and they sit there and they enjoy the entire evening. And so I'm trying to explore those things in my stand-up where it's like, you know, it's just an interesting thing for me where we live in this country, but there's so many subdivisions of things that go on that you don't really see unless you've been in that world.
So do you see... I'm trying to phrase this question in my head. Do you see comics at the Edinburgh Festival, say, mm-hmm. the alternative? Because obviously the mainstream circuit is sort of subdivided, if you want to subdivide it into something different genres mm-hmm. and categories. Could you see someone like... Have you seen Tim Key?
Yes.
Could you see Tim Key, with what he does, mm-hmm. working in an urban circuit room?
No.
Despite the fact that, you know, he is unquestionably funny.
Yes.
And... his funniness is in kind of subtlety and invention and stuff like
yeah.
that. Is there I suppose what I'm asking is there any gig where those audiences actually come together?
It'd be interesting. I don't think about the Edinburgh Festival.
I mean, Tim is obviously an extreme example.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think about an Edinburgh Festival. However, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying there's a certain set of black people that will not find him funny because there's a group of black people that might be into his comedy. But the urban rooms we played, the Coke comedy, Coke's Crime Bar, Cold Joe's Funhouse, in that basement, there was no room for that. You have to come with fire. Like, I mean, they'd give you a chance, but once they're not getting what you're going, it will just be a long day.
And is there a danger that mentality is self-perpetuating?
Yeah.
And that if you and the other comics on that circuit think we have to do a certain thing, then you make your own bed. Because
yes.
you know, there's no room to educate.
There's no room for creativity. No room for creativity. That's the problem with that. There will be no room for creativity.
Can you envisage Black Circuit comics listening to this and going, hey, I'm creative.
What the hell?
I don't think they'll take it like that, because I'm not saying they're not creative. I'm saying we kill the room for creativity. You see what I'm saying? So everyone's doing the same thing because we're afraid to do something else if it's not accepted. Ola, do you know Ola the comedian?
Yes, I do.
Ola's my
fantastic
friend.
Yeah.
Great comedian. Couldn't be accepted on the black circuit. Haunts him till now.
No
because
way.
He's different. He's okay. Very, very different. He's slow paced. He's builds up. You know, he has quirky. He has, hidden gems where it takes the thinker to get. And sometimes they just didn't want that. And he knew straight away. He would go, they'll book him for a show because some promoters would like him. And he'll tell them, I'm not your comic. You're not the one I want. You want someone else who's going to get this, give the crowd what they want. And that haunts him for a long time because. And he's a great comedian.
He's an excellent comedian.
Excellent comedian. He has everything. He knows everything about comedy. He's the one that told me to jump on the main circuit, you know? But, and that's the problem with that aspect of the urban circuit. The room for variation is not there. They want the same. It's almost like, but I don't know if it's our fault though, Stuart. Do you know what I mean? For not giving them variation. Or is it their, it must be our fault because they will only take what you give them. You know, if they, and the thing is this, the same people who were not checking, who were not giving the room for creativity, or the audiences who were a bit tough, when they see us now in the main rooms, they're so more accepting. You know, it's like, wow, I really enjoy what you're doing. You're like, I didn't think that could work on an urban circuit. Like, when I do an urban circuit show now, I have to make a decision. Am I going to pander? Am I going to do the set I've been doing on the mainstream that's been getting me this leeway? What am I going to do? You know, I have to make that decision. Sometimes I fail and I pander. I go straight back to the Nigerians make some noise, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Sometimes I'm like, I'm not doing that tonight. I'm going to go out there. If I die my ass, I die my ass. And it's that you know, it's that deep sometimes, you know, because you don't want, you know, a comic wants to lose. You know, you always want to have a good night. But sometimes I just knew in my heart, I can't go on stage and do this show. Like I turned down a show the other day because it was one of those urban gigs. And I knew he was just booking me for the name. He was just booking me for the name as opposed to my content. And I knew it was going to be one of those ones where it's a £500 gig. He's going to come up to me towards the end of the show and say, listen, we've run out of time because we did a tap dancing show in the middle of the comedy show. Can you do 5 minutes? And I didn't want to do that. You know, I said, look, man, I just told him I'm busy that day. And it's weird because everyone's like to me, you're turning down £500 for 5 minutes for me. Are you crazy? I'd go in there and just sing for 5 minutes. But when you're a comedian, when you're doing what you love, it's not about the money no more. For me, it's always about the show. The show has to be good, man. Like, I have to have given them something and they've taken it and we've had a good time. The best money I've ever been paid for a show is when a guy came up to me after the show and said to me, I got into comedy because of you. No amount of money can top that because it's like, wow, I've inspired someone. And that's why I wanted. That's why I left the urban circuit, because I knew we had to do better.
Do you think? And this is a challenging one. Do you think that there is almost a sub circuit or a sub genre of the sort of Soho theatre show where you're pitching the show as, this is my background, this is my origin. The show is called Legal Immigrant. I feel like there's more than one non-white comic doing a show about their immigration, their personal journey. Is that, are you aware of that as a sort of a, do you have to tread carefully to not try and sell the same product as a lot of
definitely
other people
definitely
have said
I mean
before?
because I was going to call my show Minority Report, but then someone told me Abba Vidal called hers Minority Report back then, so I had to say okay, stray away from that. The reason why I called it Legal Immigrant was because, even though I felt like, I guess as a minority, you feel like even if you're born and raised in England, you still have that tie to your origins. So you're legally allowed in this country, but in some way you're still an immigrant. So that's why I call it Legal Immigrant. And but I guess there is that feeling that you don't want to, you know, push the same story. But even with the immigration story, everyone's story is unique. Like, no one has my story. Well, I don't think so. No one on the circuit anyway. And so, as long as I can stay true to my story, it doesn't matter what anyone else is putting out, because Fumbi's one will be Fumbi's one. Do you know what I mean? And then his one will be his one, and that one will be that one. But the reason why everyone does that is because it's like, okay, yeah, you know, I have this edge. You have to get in with your unique selling point. You've heard that before, haven't you, Stuart?
Yeah.
Your USP. What's your unique selling point? And whether I like it or not, my unique selling point is I was born in Britain and I have Nigerian parents.
Is there, if you look at like Chris Rock's unique selling
point,
it's not his journey as a black guy in America so much as his viewpoint.
Yes.
His attitude.
His attitude.
So is that what you are kind of, is that the thing that the next thing you have to chase is actually the USP not being the story of where you're from, but the story of where you're at.
And that's what I'm trying to see. When I'm trying to be more British. I'm trying to accept myself in this country, you know, and not have that you're Nigerian or yeah, I should be more this or that. You know, I'm trying to be more me. And that's right. So it's my viewpoint of me in England as this guy. You know, it's like when I go on stage and talk about the Brexit and I'm like, guys, I don't know anything about the Brexit. Do we know what's going on? I'm talking about how I feel now, you know? Yeah. And that's where I got the whole thing. Can you imagine my mum is looking down on people now, you know?
Sure.
That's where that's coming from, you know? Before, you're right, it's like, you know, that entry point, you're trying to find your feet. But like you said, it's more about Chris Rock's viewpoint now, as opposed, when he first started, it was a straight bunch of, you know, whatever. But now it's his take. Same as Chappelle, now it's their take of themselves in America. Yeah. And that's where I want to get to, where I'm talking about myself.
So we've got to wrap up, but let me ask you, this is a thing I enjoy asking people, sometimes it could be quite difficult. Review yourself. If you were a critic watching you do a show, what areas do you think are your strengths and what areas do you think are your weaknesses? And this is a very personal, like...
My strength is I'm naturally funny. Without being the arse you said at the beginning, but I think what I get a lot of the times, I'm naturally funny and I'm very likable. When you do stand up, you got to read what people say about you. It's so important, whether you like it or not, because that's how you can't see yourself on that stage. They see you, and I know I'm instantly likable. I lost my cool at the Comedy Store the other night.
Go on.
And Mandy Knight came up to me and said, "Fumbi, you can't lose your cool on stage because of your persona."
What happened?
Someone's talking.
Okay. Do you know, I think I have a very similar problem to this. It's very hard to say this about oneself. I'm a likeable act. That's part of what I'm selling is likeability.
Yeah, it's likeability, yeah.
And if I lose my temper...
It's not likeable.
It's not likeable, and you're breaking the contract.
And I yelled at him. Not even yelled, just told him to shut up. And at him, but the whole audience was like, oh,
yeah,
we liked him.
Yeah, and I don't know what you get. I get...
That's what I'm saying. That's even worse, because they're like, oh, he's getting upset now, is he?
Exactly.
And it's like, I had to realize that, you know, that's your brand. Imagine Michael McIntyre going off on it doesn't matter how it looks, it's Michael McIntyre yelling at someone. Oh my God, what's wrong here? You have to stay in that moment. And I had to learn that, because I'm a likable act, like you said. Like I said, I'm a likable person. So I use that as a strength. And I use that to say a lot of the stuff I can try and say, especially with race, and get away with it, because they're like, oh, but he's likable, you know? Yes. I think my weaknesses are, I hate writing. And
like why do you hate writing? Have you made lots of attempts to sit down and hack out?
I have a very short attention span. It's ridiculous. It's so bad. Like, I can be trying to write material, look out the window, and I'm in Spain after that.
Do you give yourself a hard time about that? Or do you let yourself go? Oh, okay.
But you know what it is? I found a way that works for Fumbi.
Okay.
I realize I'm not a sit down writer guy. So what I do is I sit down, I put out the pen and everything, I start writing nonsense. I write little words, I write them sideways to keep my mind educated and excited. I'd write in different colors. I'm like a 5-year-old, man. And then, but this gets me excited. Then I start talking about my routines. Then I get up, pick up the aftershave thing, stand up in front of my room, start doing my routine.
Okay, on your own in the room.
On my own room, okay. Yeah. Find my nuances, you know, as you're a natural person. And I say, okay, that sounds fine. That sounds funny. You know, when you try it with someone, you know, then I call my trusted friend, run out the routine. You know, it's like, that's all shit for me. Like, yeah, I knew it was bad. I knew it was bad. But what I've done is I've tried something. Sometimes it works great. You know, you go, oh my God, I've got a good routine here. And that's how I realized that's how Fumi's going to write. So I found how it worked for me. Like, I have to get up. I can't sit down. Sometimes I go for a walk. This is my writing session. Like, I started writing, like, I'm going to write for 2 hours now. I started writing 10 minutes in, I'm going for a walk. But what I'm going to do on that walk is pave everything in my head. Keep talking about it. Sometimes on the street, I'm talking to myself, but like, is he okay? And then you're like, okay, that sounds good. I go back, I write the punchline points that I want to get on. And then I go to the comedy club and I run it through. Sometimes you forget, sometimes you remember, but that's how I made it work for me. And that's not my only, that's the weakness I have. And also, I hold back too much. I'm always afraid to try something. I'm always afraid to fail.
Okay. On stage.
Failing on stage is probably the best thing for every comedian.
Yeah.
But we don't want to do it.
It's the hardest thing.
You know, Stu, when you got that...
That's the people who are really good are the people who went out there and failed and failed and failed.
I was watching Bill Hicks one time, and I remember I did my my show. Tom from, I forget his surname, he directed my show. And he said to me, do you know why Bill Hicks is such a great comedian? I said, no. He said, because he was comfortable with silence. And that changed my whole Edinburgh show. Because silence for me means you're dying, you're dead, get off stage, or be funny. Whereas for Bill Hicks, silence was whatever. He would do a punch and it didn't even go over. And he didn't even break a sweat. And I'm like, are you okay? They're not laughing. Whereas me, and that's what I had to understand. You know, I'm trying to find a new opener now. My opener's so good, I can't let go. Now, I need a new opener. Desperately need a new opener. I'm so afraid to just fail on like 10 openers until I get the right one. And that's what I'm trying to learn. You know, it's so important to just say, you know what? Like Patrice used to say, I'd go out and I'd do a 10-minute routine. I'm more excited about that 2 new minutes I tried than the entire 8 that I know. And that's what I'm trying to learn, you know? Go out there, just try that new stuff. It might not work.
Just saying that alone is like, are you serious?
You've broken a sweat.
Exactly. I'm like, am I talking here? It might not work, which is the scariest thing ever. But at least
That's the danger. You've got to unpick the danger in the background of smashing it and smashing it in a different environment.
It's not good.
You can't keep doing that.
I smashed a new material night, Stuart. Waste of time. Even Christian said to me, Fumba, you got to start doing these new material nights. Otherwise, you're not going to get nothing from it. And it's true. I stopped going to new material nights looking to have a good gig. I went there looking to have a car crash. I'm like, why am I going to this? This is a new material night. Why am I soaring? You know, that means I'm not learning nothing. You know, let go of all of that. Go to new material night. I went to Top Secret. Didn't even write much. Just had 2 ideas in my head and went on stage and said, whatever happens will happen. At the end of the day, and then I just tell the crowd, listen, man, I'm funny. You guys have just been whatever. And then, you know, whatever, whenever I can get out of it. But I have to learn to film more.
Top Secret is the future of comedy.
Oh,
I was having this conversation, I've mentioned this before on the show, having this conversation with Tanya Moore about how it's the only mixed, really mixed crowd in London.
Foreigners come out to Top Secret.
Yep.
And when they get your gags, you're like, wow, I'm back in towards Romania tomorrow.
It's not just tourists and it's not just old people or young people or black people or white people.
Yeah, it's a mixed crowd.
It's a really mixed crowd. And I think that's why it's got so much energy to it. And the new
material nights are great.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, like people come out, they give you a chance. You know, even if it's not funny, you know, you give you a chance and you're really working out. You know, and that's what I love about comedy, the mainstream anyway, the workout aspect. We get to work out gig, until you got a solid 20, you know? When you got a solid 20, you know, think about a comedian is when you have a solid set, you're never nervous. You're like, you can't wait till you hear this shit. Wait till you hear what I have to say, you know? When it's not that solid 20, that's when you're like, okay, you know, do you want to go on first? I'll go on third, you know? And that's what I'm trying to, you know, I'm just trying to get that moment where I'm like, you know what? I'm not afraid to just die on this stage. I can just be me. And I think once I can get that, yeah.
So last question, you can interpret this however you like.
Mm-hmm.
What would you have engraved on your comedy gravestone?
Wow. What would I have?
Take as long as you like. I'll cut the silence.
Oh my gosh, that's an interesting one. I don't know. I'll probably just have something like Fumbi. Just Fumbi. Fumbert. I'd have Fumbert. Fumbert did it. I don't know, man. It's weird. I think I'll just have... Hopefully, I'd like to think I'd achieved the things I wanted to in comedy. And if it's just... I wanted to call my show The Fumbi Thing Is, because my name is Fumbi and it's funny and, you know, the mix on words. So maybe I'll have, you know, The Fumbiest Man Alive. It's just short for The Funniest Man Alive, but you know what I mean. The Fumbiest Man Alive, may he rest in peace kind of thing. You know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. Something funny like that.
Thanks, man.
Thank you very much. I've had a great time, Stuart, man. This has been one of the best podcasts I've ever done. So,
thanks for having me,
man. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
So that was Fumbi. Many thanks to Fumbi. Thanks for coming along. It's a whole other world, right? The whole of the black and urban circuit. I'm going to get along to see some urban circuit gigs and... I mean, it sounds awful to say I'm going to report back. That's not what I mean at all. But Certainly, there's a gap in my knowledge there, which I hope to shore up. I'll do a bit of research, go and see some live shows. It's just hard when I've got this. It's the Ken Dodd syndrome. It's the Ken Dodd problem. I am desperate to do an interview with Ken Dodd. I really want to see him live before I invite him to do an interview. He gigs constantly, but not frequently, if you see what I mean. And his gigs tend to be either miles away from where I am or on Friday and Saturday nights where I'm making money to feed my family. So, guys, donate me some money to the Ken Dodd Fund and I'll take a night off work and go and see Ken Dodd somewhere and I'll get him, because obviously we want to hear from Ken. I am also doing some further booking for Montreal and LA Podfest and what have you, but I'll tell you all about that in the waffle if you care to stick around. That's all for now. Thank you very much to Johnny Mountzer, who is my temporary editor, taking the place of Nathan Wood for the moment. And thank you to you for listening. Thank you to Emily Crosby for her logging skills, and indeed Olivia Phipps, who's back on the logging horse, and Matt Hoss and Simon Zek, who are helping me out with a little project as well. So thanks to all of those guys and girls, and that will do us for now. The baby's woken up. That concludes the podcast. I'm going to go and rescue the baby. Then there may be a little waffle. Well, thanks for joining me for this. It might not be very long. I'm struggling to get over the Brexit vote. The risk of I think I said as much last time. I'm not taking any correspondence on this. I've got enough going on in my life. I'm just venting. So if you disagree with me, that's absolutely fine. You can switch off or find other people to talk about. It's just so, oh God, it's okay. What are the positives? Very exciting time politically, isn't it? No one knows what the hell is going on and everything's falling apart. I am scared for my baby. I'm gutted for him. I want him to be European. I want him to be European in a sense other than simply because he lives in the landmass, the agreed continent of Europe. But I want to have a little European guy. I want him to be able to I was going to say, I wanted to be able to wear a Mexican hat if he wants to. Well, that is still absolutely his right. But I want him to be connected. I benefited so much from college going to... I did like a three-month project in the Netherlands in the Hogeschool voor de Kunst in Utrecht, and really benefited from it. It was like an Erasmus program with European funding, and that was great. I tell you what, the most tangible... I was at Glastonbury over the weekend, and that was fun with a baby for the first time, because if you thought it took a long time to organise you and all your friends to leave the tent and go somewhere, try adding someone who needs randomly timed naps to the mix. But on the last night, on the Sunday, I went and saw Plaid. Absolutely love Plaid. And hello to Jamie Porteous, if you happen to be listening to this, who is a fellow Plaid fan and also turned me on to the band Holy Fuck, who I'm very much enjoying. But I was chatting to Jamie and a couple of his friends, and they were talking about how they'd met at the University of Plymouth. And they said, oh, I mean, it's, you know, I won't slag it off on their behalf, but they said words to the effect of, you know, it's not the prettiest city in the country, but we always thought eventually it'd get European capital city of cult. Oh, well, it won't now, will it? And that was a really crushing, tangible kind of a notice that there we go. Nope, that's not happening anymore. I'm still clinging on to the idea that it may not happen because it's so politically toxic. And these awful stories. I was talking to my partner earlier on this week, trying to lend some kind of balance and calmness. And basically, I'm as freaked out as she is. But I was trying to give a... What's the devil's advocate when you're not just using it as an excuse to be a bell end? I don't know. Maybe like devil's advocate, but like devil's opponent. She was freaking out about all these racist attacks that have been happening recently. And I said, come on, let's take this... calmly and casually. Obviously they are going to be more, it's a thrilling narrative, isn't it? When newspapers are all about thrilling narratives, there were already racist incidents, and now the possibly, who knows, maybe the same number of racist horrible incidents taking place, maybe they're coming up higher in everyone's news feed, to use a Facebook analogy for print media, but you know, they're being focused on because it's a more thrilling narrative that, oh, we've done a Brexit vote. And the country's gone to shit, and we've just empowered all the racists and made all the racists feel they have license. I'm not calling everyone that voted Leave a racist, but, you know, everyone that... Well, it's not my quote, but certainly all the racists voted Leave. So
we... No correspondence. and so I was trying to make that point, and I couldn't even make that point because anecdotal evidence isn't evidence, but anecdotally speaking, holy shit, my timeline and my Twitter feed and everything is just absolutely clogged up with people reporting personal stories of seeing people in public places feeling, if not racially abusing people directly in some awful tram YouTube incident, then at least feeling far freer to say racist things in public. Feeling like, oh look, a majority of us, whether or not that's the case, the perception is that the majority of us are happy if everyone were to leave. And that's just, I mean, it's just mangled, isn't it? It's just a horrible situation to think that. I was listening to Radio 4 last night, listening to a panel of business leaders discuss the options. And literally the best option, the best case, is that everything remains the same except we have less of a say, far less of a say. You know, we're not going to... Oh, Christ, Gove? Gove? Are you kidding me? Gove? We're not going to have a situation where a Tory leader takes charge, hits the button, and then is prepared to accept free movement. I can't see that happening. That would be the least worst case. So if we're not prepared to accept free movement of people... And my dad lives in Spain. He's an expat. And I've always been very proud that among all of his friends, he's the only expat English person living in amongst his friends, certainly in Spain. Hello, if you're listening. You're all very lovely people. I've always been very proud. My dad is the only person who's learned any Spanish. But what are they now? These immigrants, they're going to be immigrants from our point of view, immigrants from Spain. You know, they're okay, residents, residencias and what have you. You know, they're not all going to get sent packing, but we want free movement. I want free movement. And the idea that that collectively a majority of us voted for something which we either didn't understand or which we thought meant something else, or which we didn't understand the ramifications of. Jesus Christ, this is why we voted politicians in, so that they could cope with this incredibly difficult stuff. I remember seeing Michael Legg. Hello, Michael. I remember seeing Michael Legg tweeting, Facebooking days before, for days. It's just an opinion poll. It doesn't mean anything. And it should be just an opinion poll, because... I was chatting to a friend of mine yesterday who said, and I completely agree with this, I'm more politically engaged now, at the moment, this last week, than I probably ever have been. I'm listening to podcasts, reading a lot of newspapers, and blogs and so on. And I still can't remotely get my head around it or understand all the ramifications of it. So what good have all of the rest of us, what good have I, who at that time wasn't doing that kind of level of research? Why should we be allowed? I want a benevolent dictatorship. And I want it now. God, it's distressing. I hope we sort it out. Anyway, I can't, you know. People were saying, I mentioned the Shappy episode. People were saying that what Shappy's opinions about feeling part of something were particularly bittersweet given the ensuing result. So if you haven't checked out that episode, please go back and listen to it. I'm sorry this... as waffles go, you may not agree with this one politically, but I'm just expressing a sense of bleakness, a sense of, like, if this were an episode of The Walking Dead, right, and I'll try not to spoil anything, I feel like the... I often think this in terms of, you know, political terms. It's all just about, we've all crash-landed on an island called the world. What are we going to do? We're going to try and band together and try and get along. And obviously, within that... We crash-landed here 5,000 years ago. You know, so go back to the beginning of the Egyptians, say, for the sake of argument. And so, obviously, those crash-landed people will initially draw up battle lines, seize their own territory, all the rest of it. But you would like to hope that after a while, we would all start to evolve and go, no, we are better together. We're better when we're all intermingling. I just believe that in my core, in my heart. We're better... when we work with people rather than seceding and becoming isolationist and going, no, we're fine. Laurie Penny, with whom I rarely see entirely eye to eye, wrote a great article I read in the
I can't remember what it was. New Statesman? Spectator? What's the one that aggregates all the things? You can tell how pathetically apolitical I am. Not apolitical, I mean how pathetically little research I do. Because, let's face it, I'm even now putting off mowing the lawn. Laurie Penny said, all these people are saying, I want my country back. And that's a, you know, that's a first level. What do you mean you want your country back? Well, you mean some kind of ludicrous cream tea scone 50s version of the country that doesn't exist anymore? But she was saying, I want my country back. And I do. I want back the country we had 2 weeks ago, before the vote, before the result, where we felt like we want to be included. So to conclude my Walking Dead metaphor, you've got to band together. What are we going to do? What, we're all going to just climb a tower and pull up a drawbridge and go, no, we're fine here, thanks, we'll just be fine here and for the rest of time? No, we've got to bloody well work together. And the idea of this, we'll got to trade. We'll trade from a weaker economic position. Fine. Okay, if that's going to happen, fine. What do I know about economics? Okay, we'll be worse off. We'll all have less money in our pockets. The amount of comments underneath these Mail and Sun articles explaining, oh, this is how badly Brexit's going to hit your wallet. And the amount of comments underneath going, oh, well, you really could have explained this a couple of weeks ago. Thanks, would have been useful. I mean, that's devastating. But in your Walking Dead metaphor, you've got to band together, and you've got to, you know, the apocalypse has happened, the dinosaur apocalypse has happened, and we've been working for it. Everything is that an interesting premise? Everything is inherently post-apocalyptic because we're all just trying to scrap around making sense of it all. And, you know, the government and social structures like the government and NASA any kind of organisation, Pixar, whoever, they're all just further down the line, they're all just versions of banding together, and a couple of people in the post-apocalyptic metaphor, they're two people getting together and doing some scribbling. There we go, we've done some scribbling. We'll send scribbling to the rest of the community, the post-dinosaur apocalypse community. Oh, I mean, if I had you before, I've lost you now. Anyway, my point is, I'm upset and angry and sick, and I've got to go mow the lawn. Trying to find some time with my baby. Very difficult. You can't mow the lawn with a baby and a papoose. It's simply not safe. Thanks for listening. If you did, if you made it this far, well done. If you made it this far, give me a comcom at comcompod. Give me the hashtag _horse and not the word underscore. We're not that clever. And just let me know you made it this far. And you can vent at me on Twitter, but I probably won't respond. Say nice things and I'll click like. That's all I've got time for, and to be honest, not even that. And if you consider me some sort of awful, archaic, super lefty, then you know, that's your right to think that. But this is on your head. Speak to you soon. Bye for now.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.